shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602. And will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Kingdom Identity Ministries welcoming you to another one of our first of the month Kingdom Concepts broadcasts. We're being heard tonight over WWCR 4.840 megahertz, WBCQ 7.415 megahertz. There's a internet stream from each of those stations. Plus, if you go to our website, kingidentity.com, KINGIDENTITY.com, then go to our radio page and scroll to the bottom of the page and you'll see some links to our Kingdom Concepts broadcast in Winamp, MP3, Windows Media, etc. And that will be your clearest listening link online. Tonight we're going to talk about something that all of you are aware of. We're in an economic crisis. We have problems every time you go to the store. Prices are higher, either that or the quantities are lower. And we're going to be talking about money, not just money from man's solution, but we're going to be from God's solution. My guest tonight is a man who's spoken on the solution, biblical money solution, for many years. He's written a number of books on the subject. And I'd like to welcome back to the broadcast a longtime friend, Bruce McCarthy. Welcome,
brother. Good evening, Mike. How are you?
Just fine. How are you doing?
Doing quite well, thank you.
You've written a recent book, I believe it's about to be published, called Lawful Money versus Legal Plunder. Just what is lawful money, and how do you define the legal plunder that we're going through today?
Well, thank you for mentioning the book. Yes, that's the new title. In fact, the new title actually is Lawful Money Plaintiff versus Legal Plunder Defendant. And we've kind of gone on the attack, I guess you might say, and it's been kind of formulated in the way of a legal dissertation and styled much like a complaint or a motion or a brief in a legal action. Lawful money has been defined in the United States statutorily. If you go back to the Coinage Act of April 2nd, 1792, at Section 11, it said that all the gold and silver coins which shall be issued from said mint, that was the Philadelphia Mint, shall be as money. Section 16 of that Coinage Act said that all the gold and silver coins which shall be issued from said mint shall be a lawful tender in all payments whatsoever. The title of my book makes a distinction between not only money and a play on words, plunder, but also a distinction between the word lawful and the word legal. Lawful contemplates the substance of law, and the word legal merely contemplates the form or the appearance of law. In fact, there's a phrase that you will hear used from time to time called color of law. So what I've attempted to do with the title is to challenge the reader right up front to the fact that there is a distinction between lawful money and between legal tender. A legal tender being those generally green rags that people erroneously call money. It was never called money. It was merely legal tender. And I made a play on words by calling it legal plunder. And the reason we do so is because since we no longer have gold and silver coins, which circulated as our lawful money, and we no longer have even legal tender, because legal tender is the form of law, tender is the offer to pay the money. But since the Kennedy assassination back in 1963, in fact, a couple of days after the assassination, the Federal Reserve began issuing its first no-promise notes. And a note, by definition, is an absolute and unconditional promise by the maker or the drawee to pay a sum certain of money to a specified person or a bearer at a specified time or on demand. And nowhere on a Federal Reserve note since the Kennedy assassination does it identify who is paying, what is being paid, when it's going to be paid, or to whom it would be paid. So therefore, there is no offer. Therefore, a Federal Reserve note cannot be a tender, and therefore it can't even be a formalistic offer to make a tender or a payment. And so they're not even legal tender any longer. They are what I call legal plunder instruments.
Some of the patriots say that the Kennedy assassination was caused because of this issue. They say the same thing about the Lincoln assassination. How do you stand on those issues?
I don't know the accuracy of that. I have some material in my possession or have had it come through my hands from time to time where Kennedy was going to issue more United States notes. In fact, I even had some documentation that showed he was going to start restoring, I believe, silver certificates to circulation. And I suspect that there could be, and probably is, a connection between what he was attempting to do and perhaps even what Lincoln did. And because there would be a likelihood that the Federal Reserve could somehow be behind the assassination of Kennedy. And then we could blame the military-industrial complex or a host of other parties who would be convenient scapegoats. But what I'm quick to point out when people generally point to Lincoln being assassinated because he issued United States notes, many people say that he was assassinated because what he was doing was a constitutional move, and the bankers didn't like that. And I would say that, number one, it wasn't a constitutional move to issue United States notes, and the bankers did not want any competition. And so they eliminated the competitor who was trying to horn in on their game. So, because there's no provision in the Constitution for legal tender.
It's my understanding also in the Kennedy case that while he did issue Treasury notes at that time, that this was a standard procedure up until that time that periodically Treasury notes would be issued by the various presidents. And I'd like to also point out that just because both of them, Lincoln and Kennedy, did something that was better than perhaps their predecessors at the time, that doesn't make them heroes. I know, and you probably remember this too, when Kennedy was in office, all the patriots, the true patriots, opposed him because of various socialistic things he did. Then after he was assassinated, he suddenly became a great patriot in the eyes of some of the so-called patriots, and he wasn't. Lyndon Johnson came in and pushed through the integration laws and a number of other things that Kennedy would have pushed through had he had the opportunity, and his brother came in and to office and did some of the same things that Jack Kennedy would have done.
Yeah, I found myself also being drawn emotionally to a more pro John Kennedy position myself. I was a, I guess you'd call me a Goldwater conservative back in the 1960s, and I didn't regard what Kennedy was doing back then as being pro-American. I think most of us, however, no matter what side of the spectrum we were on, would admit that it was not a lawful way to dispose of a president, even if the president was operating contrary or seeking to somehow undermine constitutional and American interests. So I think emotionally we were maybe drawn more to Kennedy because of how he was done away, his demise.
And, of course, Johnson easily won the election after the assassination from the sympathy vote. Let me mention here something that I forget, sometimes do forget. Our toll-free number, if anybody would like to join us tonight, is 877-924-7722. I'll repeat that, 877-924-7722. You can remember that by 877-YAWS-RACE. If you'd like to ask Bruce any questions or have any comments, we'd be happy to put you on the air. like I said in the introduction, you've been speaking on the subject of lawful money for a long time. And, of course, the real lawful issue is not what the Constitution says is lawful money, but what the Bible says is lawful money, because, as I know you've pointed out before, there's only two kinds of law, God's law and man's law. Would you like to comment further on that?
Oh, certainly. Scripturally, we're commanded to have just weights and measures. In fact, it was Roger Sherman who had written a caveat against injustice prior to the ratification of the Constitution. I believe he was a constitutional delegate from Connecticut, if my memory serves me correctly. He was the man responsible for Article 1, Section 10, and Paragraph 1, where no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. And he had said that when a country has a fluctuating medium of exchange, which changes in value, it is no better than unjust weights and measures, which is anathema to Scripture. And so the Bible commands that we're going to have just weights and measures, which presupposes that there must be something to be weighed and to be measured. And we weighed and measured our coinage, both gold and silver, in a decimal system, which was called dollars and cents. Most people are not aware of that the word dollar is actually a unit of weight measurement. But you'd have to go to the Coinage Act of April 2nd, 1792, at Section 20, to discover that. But it said that the money of account of the United States shall be expressed in dollars or units, dimes, tenths, cents, hundredths, mills, thousands. And it went on to say that all the proceedings in the courts and all the accounts kept in all the public offices at all levels of government, local, state, federal, shall be kept and had in conformity to this regulation, which no public office any longer does. All public offices are in violation of this law. And someone will say, well, that's an old law. It's an old law that's actually predicated in part upon Scripture, which commands just weights and measures. In fact, Congress was given the power in the Constitution at Article 1, Section 8, and Paragraph 5 to coin money, regulate the value thereof, that meaning the weight and the purity of the coin, so they all came out regulated, and that they were to fix a standard of weights and measures. And so a Bureau of Weights and Measures was established. And they defined by statute what they meant by dollar when they weighed silver coins and when they weighed gold coins. But that was very close. I believe they missed the mark, however. And it's a rather convoluted subject to try to discuss without being able to show the listener to your program the actual coins to show how it was violated. But I believe it was done unintentionally. But within the gold system and within the silver coinage system, there were just weights and measures in that we had a perfect harmony between and among the coins in each of the separate systems. Where a problem emerged was where you had the gold coins sitting next to the silver coins, and a serious problem or flaw emerged where you had a weight, a large, and a weight, a small, both of which were called dollar. You had a gold coin that was 1/16th the weight of a silver coin, which also carried the same denomination. And that created confusion. They had a reason why they did it, but it led to unjust weights and measures. And I would commend Thomas Jefferson, who I know has come under condemnation many a time because of his, many times people would regard him maybe as an unchristian sort of fellow, but he had written to Alexander Hamilton and said that he, for one, would have preferred that our coins be weighed in ounces, and therefore fractions thereof, so as to keep our system of weights and measures consistent, which is what ancient Israel did when they weighed their coins, or actually not coins, they didn't have coinage initially, later on they did, but they weighed them in shekels. And you weighed the hair of Absalom's head. It was polled annually, and it weighed so many shekels. The spearhead of the Philistine Goliath weighed so many shekels. Everything that the Hebrews measured by weight was measured in shekels, including the weight of their coinage. And in the United States, we should have done the same thing. We should have been weighing our bread, our hamburger, and all of the other objects that we weigh in the same system as we would weigh our coins. And that would have eliminated a tremendous amount of confusion that surfaced as a result of using the decimal system, dollars and cents. But dollars and cents were thought to be good because it facilitated easy math, because it was a base 10 system, much like people like the metric system today.
And you still could have a weight system like one troy ounce or one-tenth of a troy ounce in the decimal system.
Yeah, you could have operated that, and you could have done that in tenths, too. That's an interesting point. But we chose to go decimal in dollars and cents, and it did work out easy math, but it proved to be a confusing word. And Jefferson said that in the letter to Hamilton. He said, "It must be admitted by all the world that there is great uncertainty in the meaning of the term dollar. But once Congress has defined what they meant by it, this uncertainty," he thought, "had been resolved." But unfortunately, it wasn't, because when people looked at the coins, they were just looking at the word dollar or the letter D on a coin, and somehow they just didn't quite get it, that that's a unit of weight measurement. But you can see that in the book, because in my book, I display the gold coins on a particular page and the silver coins on another, and I show the weight of the coin in the decimal system and the weight of the coin in the troy system. And you can see the harmonious relationship in that a $1 weight of gold, let's say it's 25.8 grains of gold, 0.900 fine, and a $10 weight is exactly 10 times that weight. And so you simply move the decimal point to the right one place, and you have 258 grains to a $10 coin. And the same was done in the silver coinage, except that they had a different decimal system for silver than they had for gold. And again, they had their reason for doing that, but it introduced a level of confusion that I have attempted to unravel in the book. It's easier to unravel it in print and with the pictures than it is to try to do that over the phone tonight.
Well, as I mentioned also in the introduction, we're in an economic crisis. It's something that everybody knows. And we're not just going through a cycle, as some people think. You know, you have your ups and downs in your economic cycles, but it's actually because of the system itself, especially, I guess, since the Federal Reserve System in 1913 and then later taking the backing and even out of the Treasury notes and Federal Reserve notes.
Yeah, I think you make a good point there also, that it's not just simply a cycle. There are cycles that we see, much like you would see the rhythm of the ocean, for example, the waves as opposed to the swells. The waves may be going in one direction, the swells going in another direction, but then you also have the tidal variation on a six-hour basis from high to, to high to low tide. Over the last 200 years or more, there has been a war which has been waged between hard money and intangible bank credit. The intangible bank credit won. But that war started almost from the time the first Europeans began to colonize these shores. And one of the early phases of that war came about during the War for Secession, when Abraham Lincoln resorted to the printing of United States notes with the act that was passed in 1861 to do so, when everybody who voted for it was against that act, everybody in Congress, with possibly one exception. Everybody knew they were violating the Constitution when they did it, and they said so when they voted to issue the Lincoln greenbacks or the United States notes. But the whole idea, they said, was that after the war was over, when the Treasury could restock its reserves of silver and gold, that it would start paying down those notes. It would start paying down its debt. And the problem, of course, was that we continued to utilize Lincoln greenbacks. There was a provision to keep a certain number, I think it was $450 million in United States notes in continual circulation. I think you kind of brought that up when you mentioned Kennedy, because he was, I think, going to basically restore that $450 million figure. I think that was the number. and keep them in circulation. That basically wore down the resistance of the American people. They became accustomed to legal tender notes, and that became a perpetual thorn in our side, to where they became accepted, so that by the time the Federal Reserve Act was passed in 1913, allegedly as a consequence because of an economic aberration, you might call it a bank panic or whatever, in 1907, in answer to that bank panic of 1907, they established a monetary commission in Congress. They then sent some of these congressmen over to Europe to see how the European countries handled their economic crises, bank panics. And they were introduced to the central banking concept. And so when they came back, they said, we need a central bank. And there were several bills. You could choose between this bill and that bill, but every bill gave you a central bank. So the question wasn't whether we were going to have one or not have one. We were going to have one. It's just, are you going to pick Tweedledee or Tweedledum or some other variation of it? And we picked one, and we wound up with the Federal Reserve Act. And from the Federal Reserve Act, one of the first things that they set out to accomplish was the demonetization of gold. And so they went to war on gold. And between 1913 and 1933, they were able to issue so many IOUs against the gold that they could take the gold out of circulation and prevent the people from coming in to claim the gold because there were too many IOUs. They were going to get caught with their pants down. So they demonetized gold and made it against public policy for the American people to pay their debts in gold. Then they turned their sights on silver, and between 1934 and 1964, they waged war against that one metal. And they took the silver out of circulation in 1965. At that point, the United States had absolutely nothing in circulation as money. The United States went 100% pure credit, which the banking system gets an unlimited quantity to itself at no cost to itself. Now the banking system was able to steal without limit. While prior to that, when the Federal Reserve was first created, they only had a 40% reserve requirement on gold, which meant that 60% of the notes that promised to pay gold were fraudulent. That allowed the banking system to steal with 60% fraudulent notes. And I don't think there's anybody in your audience who wouldn't at least smile. He may be honest enough to say, no, I wouldn't do that because I'm an honest guy, but if a banker allowed the people in your audience to open up a checking account and write checks for $100, but only have $40 in the account, and the banker promises with a smile and a wink that I will clear the full amount, would you like to be able to do that? Oh, of course, you know, because $60 I don't even have to have. But my notes will all circulate, or my checks will all pass. And that's exactly what Congress authorized the Federal Reserve to do from day one. They were authorized to operate on a 40% reserve requirement. That meant 60% of the notes were able to confiscate goods and services just as if they were gold. And then they lowered the reserve requirement in 1945 to 25%, which meant that 75% of the notes were pure fraud.
It's certainly been an evil system since the Federal Reserve, but there was some manipulation by the banks prior to the Federal Reserve, weren't there? Like the Rothschilds manipulating?
Every panic, every so-called bank panic, was caused by banks. And it was all caused by banks over-issuing IOUs. Back in the bank panic of 1857, which affected England as well as here, the banking house of Dillon and Morrison in London was estimated by Parliament to have issued at least 50 times more IOUs than there was specie, i.e. gold and silver coin, on deposit. Well, that'd be like a real estate developer selling a one-acre parcel of land to 50 different people. Would there be anything wrong with that? Well, of course there would. That's fraud. And it's theft. So in 1857, you even had banks over-issuing IOUs to the tune of 50-fold, and that was considered a conservative estimate by Parliament. So the problems, the bank panics that we had prior to the Civil War, War for Secession, and afterwards that have occurred were all caused by the over-issuance of credit against the substance.
Well, this kind of brings up another subject. We know scripturally that gold, silver, and brass or copper as lawful money. But some patriots criticize going to a gold standard because they say that the Rothschilds would manipulate the value thereof. How do you answer that?
Well, that's quite easy, actually. First off, the United States was never on a gold standard. And I realize if you go to Black's Law Dictionary and you go to the statutes, you'll find that America was allegedly on a gold standard from 1900 to 1934. But you have to ask yourself, first off, how do you define this word gold standard? I've seen four different definitions for gold standard. And if I have to have four different definitions to figure out whether I'm on one, I've definitely got to get an answer from somebody as to which one of the four are you talking about. But a gold standard, if you go to Black's Law Dictionary, basically means that you are using gold as money, or that every one of your IOUs is a claim check against gold at par, which means if you've got a $100 gold note, then that note has got to be able to claim a $100 weight of gold. And if it won't, then you're not on a gold standard. Now, the nature of banking has always been, going all the way back to England back in the 1600s when they first started this kind of a present-day banking system using credit instruments, banks have always overissued credit instruments. Banks have never operated on a 100% redeemability scheme. They have always overissued IOUs. You were never on a gold standard in the United States, ever. Okay, so that's the first problem. The depressions, the recessions are caused not by the gold, but by the overissuance of IOUs. But we're taught to blame the gold. There's nothing inherently wrong with gold. In fact, in Genesis chapter 2, verse 11 and 12, it says, "In the land of Havilah there is gold, and the gold of that land is good." Why would God tell us that in Genesis chapter 2? We've hardly gotten into the Bible. He's already told us in Genesis 1 that everything he created was very good, and in Genesis 2, he's telling us that gold in the land of Havilah is good. So how can we declare that what God has made, gold, silver, brass, or anything else? In fact, he told Moses in the book of Exodus to receive from the people as offerings the first three substances, you remember, that he commanded Moses to receive from the people were gold and silver and brass. Now, copper is the primary element in brass. And if we go to Christendom, all of the European nations and the descendants of those Europeans here over in America and in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and so forth, what did we use as money prior to going with the credit system and succumbing to the Rothschild, Rockefeller cabal? It was gold and silver and brass. The monetary system of all white Western Christendom was exactly what Moses was commanded to receive. However, we don't use any of that anymore. We succumb to credit.
Traditionally, Christendom has also criticized usury, as the Bible does. The Bible gives the death penalty for usury in Ezekiel 18, 12 through 13.
Right.
And the Jews came in with their usury, which is all part of the banking system.
Yeah, and then somebody redefined the word usury. In fact, I heard in one of your previous broadcasts, I think it was one of your callers who correctly pointed out, and I'm sure you're aware of this, but if you go to any dictionary, like Random House, I've got a Random House College Dictionary, 1982, but you can go to Black's Law Dictionary and see the same thing. The first definition that they'll give for the word usury is excessive interest. Interest charge beyond which the law allows. Of course, they won't tell you which law they're talking about. Then you read the third definition in Random House, and the third definition is prefixed with the letters OBS, period, which means obsolete. The obsolete definition, number three, is any interest charge. And if you go to Black's Law Dictionary and you look up usury, you'll get the same sort of story, but when you go to the obsolete definition, they'll tell you in Old English law, usury was any interest whatsoever charged for the loan of money. So somebody redefined the word usury and said, well, it's now excessive interest, and so we that's kind of what the scribes and the Pharisees have been doing. In fact, whenever they wanted to trap Christ, what did they do? They tried to entangle him in his talk. They tried to trap him in his words. And it's a word game that we've been up against. Another example of that, Mike, is if you go to Black's Law Dictionary, 4th edition, the big green one, for those who've got one on their shelf, it was published, I think, up to about, I think it was published around 1968. If you look up the word bill of credit in the 4th edition, it'll tell you that a bill of credit in constitutional law is a promissory note issued by the government on its faith and credit designed to circulate in the community as money, comma, and redeemable at a future day. If you go to the 5th edition and you look up the same word, a bill of credit is, no longer do they say the phrase in constitutional law, that's deleted. They say that it's a promissory note issued by the government on its faith and credit designed to circulate in the community as money, period. They eliminate the phrase and redeemable at a future day. That was to cover up the fact that they took the promise to repay the gold or the silver on the notes after Kennedy was assassinated. Okay, I believe the Kennedy assassination was probably, among other things, a diversion. While everybody was busy watching the caissons pull Kennedy's body, or somebody's body, if it wasn't his, in the casket, down the street there in Washington, D.C. While people were busy watching TV, the Federal Reserve began issuing the first no-promise notes.
It was like it Rahm Emanuel there who said something about taking advantage of a crisis?
Yeah.
They do the same thing, the so-called Patriot Act after 9/11, when they took away a lot of our rights. They do it in a lot of areas.
It's almost like a sucker punch, you know, where a person will kind of wave his fingers over here. You look at that, and then with the other, with the left hand, he jabs you in the gut. You know? And so a diversion. In fact, I think it was John Maynard Keynes, the economist, who had said, and I can't remember where I saw that. He said that in order for his grandiose schemes to ever be fulfilled or pulled off, he didn't use the phrase pulled off, but that's what he meant. He says there must be the external threat of war. The external threat of war provides a diversion so that what you want to do at home, you can accomplish. So there are diversionary maneuvers that are accomplished. And I believe the Kennedy assassination provided a diversion. So while we were focusing on that, we went through, in effect, a horrendous economic change. We eliminated the silver from our coinage. That came out of the coinage starting in 1965. But the first no-promise note was issued in 1963. Okay? Just a couple days after Kennedy was assassinated. I think it was Des Griffin in one of his books, either Descent into Slavery or Fourth Reich of the Rich, pointed out that there were 50 million, I believe, no-promise notes that were put into circulation almost immediately upon the assassination. But we didn't notice. And, of course, that
I think George Orwell said something similar in his book, 1984, always keep the people focused on some foreign enemy.
Yeah, and I think there was a banker's manifesto in England that circulated that used the phrase, keep the people's minds occupied with things of little concern to ourselves. And then they went on to say that they could pull off their schemes. People who have old notes, like old promissory notes, treasury notes, United States notes, Federal Reserve notes, gold and silver certificates, what they will notice, no matter how far back and no matter which issue of note you're looking at, the most difficult line to see is the line that says that it will pay to the bearer on demand. Some of those notes, that line, I have seven different styles of type where the contract would begin, the United States of America will pay to the bearer on demand $10. And then it would go on to say that it was payable in lawful money of the United States, or maybe specifically payable in silver or payable in gold. Lawful money was defined, of course, as gold and silver coin of the United States, Title 12, the United States Code, Section 152. But I have notes that have as many as seven different styles of type to write that brief contract. And on those notes, the most difficult line to see is the one that is done in a very fine cursive, and that is the line that says, we'll pay to the bearer on demand. Why did they do it that way? because they knew they were going to remove that line. And it was a matter of time. When the Federal Reserve opened, 1914 is when they actually opened their doors for business. Okay, they took the promise off the last note in 1963. How many years ago? How many years later was that? Well, from 1914 to 1963, you know, you're talking about 50 years, right? And they waited that long, but from the very beginning, even the first of the Federal Reserve so-called banknotes, the smallest, the most difficult line to see was the will pay to the bearer on demand. And when they removed that line, it was the easiest to remove because nobody noticed that it was gone.
Well, I think the problem is the contract in the first place being the Federal Reserve notes, because in Scripture we're told, thou shalt make no covenant with them. It's found in both Deuteronomy and Exodus and elsewhere. And a covenant is a compact or a contract. And we're actually, by using these notes, making a contract with the enemy of our race. Whereas if you had gold or silver in coin form, there's nothing they could do to take the value away thereof.
Right, because what we're doing is when a person deals in a credit instrument, the word credit, of course, comes from the Latin word credere, which means to believe. And so what is a credit system? It's a system wherein we believe in the person who not only receives credit, but we also believe in the party who is extending it. The banking system doesn't lend money. It lends credit on credit. It does not lend money on credit. And the Bible is quite clear in the book of Proverbs, wherein Solomon had told us, you know, withhold not good from them to whom it is due, when it is in the power of thine hand to do it. Say not unto thy neighbor, go and come again, and tomorrow I will give, when thou hast it by thee. I mean, that's Proverbs chapter 3, 27 and 28. If you have the ability to pay your bills, you pay them. You don't try to defer the payment of the bill that you owe. But it's the nature of man, is it not? You know the saying, well, I'd rather owe it to you than to cheat you out of it. And that's the nature of man. In fact, that's the whole purpose of legal tender notes. The purpose of a legal tender note was so that the first party who issued them could get what you produced and pay you later. When they removed the promise from the note, which they knew they were going to do from the very beginning, that was the game plan, the object then became to get what you produce now and pay you never. The Federal Reserve System works in a symbiotic relationship with the federal government. How do we know that? Because what the Federal Reserve System does is unlawful. What is it that's unlawful? Number one, they create principle out of nothing. That's crime number one. That's the violation of just weights and measures. The dollar number, like a $100 bill, has the number 100 in the corner. What does it represent a $100 quantity of? Absolutely nothing. But that doesn't sound very technical. So what they tell you in their own books is it represents a quantity of monetized debt. What is debt? State versus douce, debt is a sum of money due. In other words, a $100 bill represents a $100 quantity of money that doesn't exist. And when you receive that bill, that $100 of the money is still due and owing to you because you never received it because the bank never put it into circulation. It's all pretense. Then they charge interest on the loan of absolutely nothing. And God forbids that we were to make loans of substance, which was generally silver. The word money in the old scriptures, you know, was kesef. The word for silver was kesef. The word for money was kesef. That's what Israel used primarily as its money. It also used gold for the big high price purchases, you know, and copper for the small ones. But we entered into a world of 100% credit, effectively in 1965, with interest being charged on the loan of an imaginary loan. So that violated another law.
Let me, at this point, give our listeners a chance to call. That's 877-924-7722 if you'd like to join the conversation tonight. Toll-free number, 877-924-7722. 877-YAWS-RACE. Bruce, why don't you also give some contact information for those who would like to get your book? I know it's a big subject, and it can't possibly be covered in a one-hour period tonight. So why don't you do that?
Okay, thanks for the opportunity to mention it. People can order the book. It's a pre-publication copy at this point. It will be going into publication here shortly. These are pre-publication copies that are offered directly from me. They can write to me, Bruce G. McCarthy, McCarthy, at 33563 State Route or Route. I'm from Maine, so I don't pronounce it the way everybody else does. 537 Graysville, G-R-A-Y, the color, S-V-I-L-L-E, Ohio, 45734. The book is available for, we'll call it $10. We don't use the word dollar because there are no dollars at law that pass from hand to hand in the United States and haven't since 1965. I would ask that people please not send checks. I do not have a checking account. It would cause me a little bit of inconvenience to try to find somebody who does, who can process the thing for me. We don't take credit cards, of course, either. But for $10, you get a copy of the book. It's 92 pages. It is well illustrated in color. I don't think you're going to find a book that is more concise with respect to laying out not only the subject and the distinction between the lawful money we once had and the legal plunder that we now are enduring, but we offer both a national solution as well as personal solutions as to what you can do to begin to extricate yourself piecemeal in a logical order from this system. I'm not saying that you can do it all by yourself, because as you get further down the road to separation from this madness, you're going to need people to trade with, and you need a lawful trade network, which we used to have one of those, but it was difficult back in the 1980s to get one up and running. Because people back in the 1980s, when we started talking about this actually in 1980, that's a few years ago, most people back then didn't see the need to even look at this issue in a real serious way. They could not foresee what people are now beginning to perceive is coming. And most people still have no clue as to what's coming. And if you'd like to see what is coming, then read the history of the French Revolution around 1790. There was a phrase, a parable that came out of that revolution, and the phrase went like this. The guillotine follows the paper money press. The two machines are complementary, one to the other. It was horrific what happened.
I suppose we could also mention Germany in the 1920s.
Yeah, Germany.
We have a couple callers. First of all, Radican, I guess it is, on from Vermont on line one. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much. It's most fascinating discussion you have. And I was put on hold right when he was giving contact information to get his book. So I didn't know if you could repeat that again before the show ends. Could you enumerate on... I've often heard that the Civil War was about freedom, freeing the slaves, but I've also heard it was basically a concentration of power, centralization of power, and also, have you investigated at all the Act of 1871, where Congress committed act of treason and sold our sovereignty to the Crown of England and the Rothschild banking family of Europe?
Okay, now the one on 1871, I have heard somewhat of something like that. I have not done original research in that area and probably would not be able to enlighten you any more than what you probably already know. As far as the Civil War or the War for Secession being a power of, a concentration, there is some evidence to show that it was basically a Masonically ordained war. That prior to the that war, the Masonic Lodge was divided into two capitals. There was a southern jurisdiction and a northern. The northern jurisdiction capital of the lodge, I believe, was Boston. The southern jurisdiction was, of course, Charleston, South Carolina. General Albert Pike, sovereign grand commander of the southern jurisdiction, was a Confederate officer. And he had written Morals and Dogma. And it appears that the idea was to divide the United States into two countries. It would make it much easier to divide and conquer. So the European banking house of Rothschild, being in the lead, was financing the South and then refusing to make loans to the North, which is why Lincoln resorted to his greenback scheme. But that war brought about several changes, distinct changes in American government and in economics. Number one, we had a war that was fought without a constitutional mandate. I have the letter from the Attorney General. His last name was Black. It was his opinion delivered to Abraham Lincoln as to whether the North had any power, express or implied, to go to war against the South. And he says there's no express power, there's no implied power to do it. And surely he ended a rather lengthy letter by saying that as soon as one part of the country arms itself against the other, the Union will surely perish. I believe the Union did perish. And out of that, we went from the United States are to a phrase that we now say the United States is. The federal government, in effect, became the Frankenstein, if you will, that kind of rose off the slab. That which was created by the states became the master. And part of its master-servant relationship that was established was that the federal government seized upon it to itself the power to emit legal tender, which is now the power to steal from everybody else who must work for numbers of nothing, which the federal government could get for free. That's a very heady power. In fact, that power is to be resurrected again. The bill is before the House. Dennis Kucinich from Ohio has presented it on behalf of the American Monetary Institute, and it calls for the nationalization of the Federal Reserve. The federal government is going to issue this stuff directly. It's going to save itself the interest, of course. Wouldn't you, if you could create money out of nothing? You wouldn't charge yourself interest. And what we will do under this bill, and I believe it's eventually going to pass because there are so many so-called patriots who promote it, they will implement strict compliance with the fifth plank of the Communist Manifesto. That's exactly what they're doing. The fifth plank says centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of state capital and an exclusive monopoly. And that's exactly what all of these bills are proposing. That's kind of my pet beef right now, and I'm glad you gave me an opportunity to somehow vent on that. I don't know if I provided you with any clearer insight as to the question you asked, but I hope I did.
Yes, you have, and I might also add that Act of 1871 also changed the Constitution from a constitutional republic to a corporation. The United States became a corporation, and they changed the phrase United States the Constitution for the United States of America, small u, small s, to the Constitution of the United States of America, all in capital letters. We became a corporation, and I think that's how Obama can be president, because he is not the president under constitutional mandates where you need to be a natural born citizen, but he is just a president of a corporation.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. I thank you for sharing that. I know there has been a lot of discussion, and I'm trying to think how far back it goes. I think it began maybe in the 80s when people started looking not only at the change of status program, but for the individual person out here, the 14th Amendment citizen subject, the United States being spelled with a capital U, a small u, the Secretary of the Treasury as opposed to the Treasury Secretary. There are lots of names that have been introduced and morphing of terminology and spellings, which
semantic engineering. As Viktor Frankl called it, be wary of semantic engineering.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
You're quite welcome. Okay, your name is what was your
Radkin.
Name? Radkin.
Radkin.
Yeah, and you're from Vermont.
Canadian border.
Yeah, I'm from Maine originally. Yeah, so it's nice to hear from a New Englander.
You know, I know New England. It's the mountains. Mountains and whatever.
Yeah.
We're all the same, though. We're more united than divided. They, as you said, though, they want to divide to conquer.
Yeah, they've done a good job.
Thank you, Radkin, for your call.
Thank you so much. And please repeat how we can get your book.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead, point. Bruce, and okay. Repeat it.
Yes, and write directly to me, Bruce G. McCarthy, 33563, State Route, or State Route, if you prefer, 537, Graysville, Ohio. And our commune number here is 45734. And, it's just $10. Stick a fraud, that's a Federal Reserve Accounting Unit device, in the envelope. And it should get to us. And you'll have the book. I think you'll find the book of interest.
Well, thanks again, Radkin. Let's go to line two. Annette from West Virginia's been waiting for a while. You're on the air.
Oh, good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Hallamore, for having Mr. McCarthy on. It's about 30 years, three decades, since I had learned of his work. It's marvelous that he's come to the fore. I have a few comments, if I may. The bill that Kennedy was introducing was H.R. 1110, which was going to put us back on a constitutional money system. And I believe that was one of the major factors why he was assassinated. Of course, he was assassinated for other reasons, too. He wanted to stop these illegal wars that we were involved in. And, he started off as a liberal, but he ended up becoming more constitutional, and that's what did him in. But then with reference to the United States, my research indicates that the gentleman who just spoke before about the United States as a corporation agrees with what I found out as well, that in 1871, August 15th, by the way, that date of August 15th seems to be a date that the Illuminati picks for a lot of very significant changes in history. And it was August 15th, 1871, that the United States Corporation was formed, which then, even though the United States of America is still in effect, it put us under a different jurisdiction. So we literally have two legal jurisdictions operating here. It depends on which one you want to use. And, of course, you'd have to know how to navigate in either one. And that's no easy thing. But the one that this Illuminati government is using is the United States Corporation, which was founded in 1871. And so I thought that may be of interest to you.
Hi, Annette. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing very well, thank you. It's wonderful to hear you.
I haven't seen you for a while.
Well, I've been buried. I've had a lot of injuries, and so I just don't get around. But I'm still a staunch Christian Israel believer and share it whenever I can.
Well, thank you.
And thank you for calling, Annette.
Thank you.
We've got a couple minutes left. I'll let you repeat your address again. And we did have a couple callers on a couple different lines, and they dropped off. And I know there's still quite a bit to cover on this subject that we haven't even touched upon. Would you like to come back next month and complete the subject, or at least bring some more of the topic?
We wouldn't complete it, but I'd be delighted to come back. I know you and Buddy Tucker had talked about a parasite and host relationship between banking and the non-bank public, and I would like to propose to people that parasites cannot live without hosts, but hosts can live much better without the parasite.
Yeah, I'd like to get into the subject that Buddy and I spoke of. If you had the power, what would you do?
Yeah.
So
okay,
I'll invite you to come back next month, and we've got less than 2 minutes left. Why don't you give your contact address once more for your book?
Okay. Bruce G. McCarthy, 33563 State Route. I'm sorry. I'll learn. 537 Graysville, Graysville, Ohio, 45734.
And that's $10.
$10.
The and subtitle, I'd like to mention that we carry a cartoon book called The Temple of Imaginary Money, which Bruce wrote the introduction on it, 2 pages, but the rest is in cartoons, easy to understand on the money situation, and we ask $3 on that. We also have a book by Pastor Compre called Babylon's Money for $2, and a lot of other material. Our contact information will be given here in a few seconds. I'd like to thank you for being our guest this month, and like I said, next month we'll take the subject up again, and I'd invite all of our listeners to write for your book and also contact us for information on various subjects. May Yahweh bless you and the audience.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a
CD
of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.